All right, welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're going to be jumping into a Supreme Court case that's super important for understanding, that whole balance of power between the feds and the states.
Yeah, definitely a key case, especially for all you law students out there trying to wrap your heads around constitutional law and how it all plays out in the real world.
It's one thing to read about these concepts in a textbook, but seeing how they actually get applied in these landmark cases, well, that's where it all really clicks. And the case we're diving into today is Maryland v. Wirtz back in 1968.
Right, Wirtz. This one really gets to the heart of federalism. It grapples with this fundamental question. When can the federal government actually step in and regulate how states run their own institutions?
And specifically, we're talking about how states handle labor practices, right?
Yeah.
Things like wages and working hours, that sort of thing.
Exactly. And in this case, it was all about whether the feds could dictate those sorts of things in institutions that were run by the states, things like state hospitals and schools.
Okay, so to set the stage here, let's back up a bit. I mean, Wirtz arose from some pretty significant changes to the Fair Labor Standards Act, the FLSA, right?
Right, the FLSA. Now, most folks listening probably know that the FLSA sets those national standards for minimum wage, overtime pay, and all that.
Yeah, it's kind of the backbone of federal labor law.
Exactly. But here's the thing. Before 1961, state governments were pretty much exempt from those rules.
Really? So states could set their own minimum wages for their employees, even if they were way lower than the federal standard?
Yeah, pretty much. They had a lot more autonomy back then when it came to labor stuff. But then in 61, Congress, they made some pretty big changes with the FLSA amendments. They introduced this thing called the enterprise concept.
The enterprise concept, okay. What's that all about?
Well, it basically broadened the reach of the FLSA in a big way. It said that if an organization, even if it's, just operating within one state, is part of a larger enterprise that does business across state lines, well, then all of its employees, they fall under the FLSA.
So think of it like, a big chain restaurant or something, right? Even if one particular location is just serving customers in its own town, the whole chain is operating across state lines, so all the employees, even in that one local spot, have to be paid at least the federal minimum wage and all that.
Exactly. That's a great analogy. So you can see how this enterprise concept really expanded the federal government's power in terms of labor regulations.
Okay, so we've got this enterprise concept in play. How does this all connect back to Maryland v. Wirtz and the states?
Well, fast forward a few years to 1966. And Congress passes another set of amendments to the FLSA. And these amendments, they explicitly state that this enterprise concept, it now includes state-operated hospitals and schools.
Ah, so that's where the conflict really heats up.
Exactly. Because now you've got the federal government essentially saying, hey, states, even though you run these hospitals and schools, they're still part of this bigger economic picture, so you've got to follow the FLSA too.
And of course, the states weren't too thrilled about that, right?
No, not at all. They saw it as a huge overreach of federal power. And that's how we get Maryland v. Wirtz. Maryland, along with a bunch of other states, they sued the federal government, arguing that Congress had gone way too far and was infringing on their sovereignty as states.
So this wasn't just one or two states grumbling about it. This was a widespread pushback against these federal regulations.
Oh, yeah. This was a big deal. I mean, 27 states in total, plus a school district, all joined in on this lawsuit. They were seriously concerned about the implications of letting the feds dictate how they ran their hospitals and schools.
So what were the main legal arguments that the states were using to challenge these FLSA amendments?
Well, there were a few key points they kept hitting on. First, there's the Commerce Clause. The states were saying, look, running hospitals and schools, that's a core government function. It's not commerce in the traditional sense. So the federal government can't use the Commerce Clause to justify meddling in our business.
Right, Commerce Clause. That's that part of the Constitution that gives Congress the power to regulate commerce among the states.
Right, exactly. And the federal government, they were relying on this idea of substantial effects. They argued that even if a state's activities are mostly happening within its own borders, if those activities have a substantial effect on interstate commerce, then Congress can step in. And they were saying, look, state hospitals and schools, they buy tons of stuff from out of state. They employ huge numbers of people. They have a big impact on the economy.
So they were basically arguing that the labor practices in these state institutions, things like wages, could ripple out and affect businesses and workers in other states. Like if a state hospital starts paying its workers way less than the federal minimum wage, that could give them an unfair advantage over hospitals in other states that are following the FLSA, right?
Exactly. It's all interconnected, they were saying.
Okay, so that's the Commerce Clause argument. What other legal ground were the states standing on?
Well, they were also really leaning on the 10th Amendment.
The 10th Amendment, that's the one about powers not specifically given to the federal government being reserved for the states, right?
Right. So the states were arguing that education and healthcare, those are traditional state functions. They're not specifically mentioned in the Constitution as being under federal control. So they're saying, hey, the 10th Amendment protects our right to handle these things without the feds butting in.
And the third legal challenge?
That was based on the 11th Amendment, which is all about state sovereign immunity. The states argued that the feds were basically trying to sue them without their consent by subjecting them to these labor rules, which they said violated the 11th Amendment.
So we've got this big showdown between the feds and the states, this clash between federal power and state sovereignty. What did the Supreme Court ultimately decide in words?
Well, in a 5-4 decision, they ended up siding with the federal government.
Yeah.
They upheld the FLSA amendments, saying that they did apply to those state-run hospitals and schools.
So how did they justify that, given all those arguments from the states?
Justice Harlan wrote the majority opinion, and he really leaned into that substantial effects test. He acknowledged that, yeah, state hospitals and schools are public entities, but they also play a major role in the economy. They buy all sorts of goods and services from other states. They employ massive workforces. And their labor practices, well, those can have ripple effects across state lines.
So the court basically agreed with the federal government's argument that even though these are state institutions, they're still big economic players, and what they do can affect interstate commerce.
Exactly. Harlan really drove this point home with a really specific example. He talked about a state university hospital, a big one. He pointed out that a place like that, they might spend millions of dollars each year on medical equipment that's manufactured in another state. Now, if that hospital decides to cut costs by paying its workers less than the federal minimum wage, well, that could potentially give them an unfair advantage over hospitals in other states that are following the FLSA.
Right, because they're able to offer lower prices or something like that, which could hurt businesses in other states.
Precisely. So the point Harlan was making is that everything's interconnected. Those labor practices in a state institution, they can have real-world effects that reach far beyond the state itself.
Okay, so that tackles the Commerce Clause issue. But what about the state's argument that they were just carrying out essential government functions? They were saying education and healthcare, those are core responsibilities of the state.
Yes, and the court, they didn't ignore that argument. They acknowledged the importance of those state functions, but they made this distinction between what they called proprietary functions and core governmental functions.
Proprietary functions. What did they mean by that?
Well, they were basically saying that when a state is doing something that's pretty similar to what a private business might do, something like running a hospital or a school where they're employing people and buying and selling stuff, well, in those cases, they're acting more like a business than like a government. And when they're acting like a business, they're subject to the same sorts of federal regulations as any other business.
So the court was basically saying, look, we get it. States have these important duties. But when they're running these big institutions that are engaging in all this economic activity, they're not immune from federal regulations.
Right. And Justice Harlan was really careful to emphasize that the FLSA, it wasn't telling states how to run their schools or hospitals. It wasn't dictating what they should be teaching kids or what kinds of medical treatments they should be providing. It was just regulating those basic economic aspects of employment,
right?
Wages and hours.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, the court also cited another case as precedent in Wirtz, right? United States v. Darby. How did that case factor into their decision?
Yeah, Darby was a really important precedent here. That case, from back in 1941, had already established that Congress had broad power to regulate labor standards under the Commerce Clause. And in Wirtz, the court basically said, look, if Congress can regulate wages and hours for private businesses that are involved in interstate commerce, then it makes sense that they can also regulate state-run institutions that are doing similar things and having similar effects on commerce. So they were building on that Darby precedent to support their decision.
So it was all about drawing that parallel between private businesses and state-run institutions that are engaging in similar economic activities.
Exactly. Now, it's important to remember that not everyone on the court agreed with this decision. Justice Douglas, he wrote a pretty scathing dissent.
What were his main points of disagreement?
Well, he was really worried about the impact this decision would have on state sovereignty. He felt that by allowing the federal government to dictate wages and hours in state institutions, the court was really chipping away at the powers that rightfully belong to the states. He said this kind of expansion of federal power could eventually destroy state sovereignty, and that it was a real threat to those traditional state functions like education and healthcare.
It sounds like he was really concerned about maintaining that balance of power between the feds and the states.
Absolutely. He saw this decision as a step too far, a move that could blur the lines of authority and ultimately weaken the state's ability to operate independently.
Okay, so Wirtz was a pretty big win for the federal government in terms of expanding their power to regulate state activities. But I'm guessing this wasn't the end of the story, right?
Yeah.
This whole debate about federalism and the limits of federal power, it didn't just stop there.
Oh, definitely not. Wirtz was a landmark case for sure. But there have been other cases since then that have sort of pushed and pulled on these boundaries. You had cases like National League of Cities v. Usury in 1976, which kind of tried to put some limits on the reach of Wirtz, and then Garcia v. San Antonio Metropolitan Transit Authority in 1985, which swung the pendulum back in the other direction. So it's been this ongoing back and forth.
So even though Wirtz established this precedent, it didn't completely settle the question of how far the federal government can go in regulating state activities.
Not at all. It really just highlighted how complex and constantly evolving this whole issue of federalism is. There's always going to be debate about where those lines should be drawn.
So for all our listeners out there, especially you law students who are grappling with these constitutional issues, Wirtz is a really great case study in how these things play out in the real world. It shows how the court interprets these broad constitutional concepts like the Commerce Clause and the 10th Amendment, and how they try to balance the competing interests of the federal government and the states.
Yeah, and it's a good reminder that these debates about federalism, they're not just abstract legal theories. They have real-world consequences for how our government functions, for what kinds of laws get passed, and for how those laws are enforced.
So to kind of bring it all together, Maryland v. Wirtz from 1968. It showed that the court, at least at that time, was willing to take a pretty expansive view of the Commerce Clause, allowing the federal government to regulate state activities that had a substantial effect on interstate commerce. But they also recognized those important principles of state sovereignty, and Justice Douglas's dissent really highlighted those concerns about overreach and the potential for federal power to erode those core state functions.
Exactly. Wirtz really encapsulates this ongoing tension within our federal system, this constant push and pull between federal power and state autonomy. And it's a tension that's still playing out today in all sorts of areas, from environmental regulations to healthcare policy to, you know, even how we regulate online businesses.
It's really a fundamental question about how we want to structure our government, about where that power should ultimately lie.
Right. And there's no easy answer. It's something that we as a society have to constantly grapple with and debate. And cases like Wirtz, they provide this really valuable framework for understanding those complexities and for thinking critically about how these issues continue to play out in the 21st century.
Absolutely. So for all of you listening, keep that in mind. Think about how that substantial effects test that was so crucial in Wirtz is still being applied today in all sorts of legal battles.
Yeah.
Think about how the pendulum of federalism has swung back and forth since 1968. And, you know, keep those questions in mind as you continue to study law and engage with these complex constitutional issues.
Yeah, the legacy of Wirtz is still very much alive and well.
All right. Well, that's going to do it for today's deep dive. Thanks for joining us, and we'll catch you next time.
Thanks for having me. It's been a great discussion.